Warning, this podcast contains bad words and stories about drugs and sex and overthrowing the government. Proceed with caution. Okay. Thank you. And now on to our show. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. Then after dinner we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about a quarter to nine, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She got a room on the second floor. Well, looks like another fucked up day in paradise.
Welcome and hello, planet Earth. This is episode 018 of the Daughter of Godcast, and I am still Dan Kelly, writer-director, with stories from the making of the featurette Daughter of God. 11 years in the making, and by the end of this episode, we'll have covered roughly 2 years, leaving just 9 to go. I trust you're having as much fun as me. Even if you're having only half as much fun as I am, you're having a lot of fun, because I am having way lots of fun. Last week, before I was ready to record episode 017, I accidentally saved over most of what I had scripted. I tried brute forcing my way through a rewrite, but that wasn't feeling fun. In finding my way back to fun, I was given a story to tell instead. The Wise Woman. I didn't have this story before the episode went south. So, did I experience a loss or a gain? If you break your leg and discover a whole new level of self-sufficiency and confidence, is that a loss or a gain? Anastasia, who read us excerpts from Ursula K. Le Guin's introduction to The Left Hand of Darkness in episode 017, recently had this very experience. Maybe we'll be seeing and hearing more from her. The variability of loss and gain seems to depend entirely on creative participation. Want to make anything feel like a big win? Decide. There's libraries of self-help books that say much the same. Summing up my acid days in the East Village, reality is whatever you believe. Here's an addendum. Believing on purpose or by default. If I'm going a little too fast, feel free to ask questions anytime. Every episode, I seem to be telling you this podcast is actually something other than what I said it was the episode before, or the episode before that. It's a model airplane. It's organic French fries. It's a pack of lies. It's your grandmother's kiss. It's all people everywhere. Well, all of the above. And we've made, are making a movie here, so you can count on that. Each episode has at least a little something about movie making, and specifically, making the Daughter of God. We're ready to revisit the start of 2007, which feels resonant as we are about to begin another new year here in RL, 2017. I'm steadily radiating, in spite of bites defying propriety, technical vexations, and aesthetic compromises. 18 weeks feels mildly shocking, yet here we are, again. You are listening to me tell stories of the making of Daughter of God. And maybe just as intriguing, you're listening to me groping in the dark, learning how to podcast, how to maintain a sustainable production schedule, and still have a life, and figuring out why I am podcasting. I am also hearing back from you, the royal you, that is, all of you, friends old and new, calling and writing to prod and encourage, and that's super fun. No one has yet told me to shut the fuck up, though I'm sure a few people have sampled my ramblings and moved on. This podcast is made possible by a generous grant from the universe, with additional support provided by the cosmos, the spooky tribe of energy allies, gorgeous Gaia herself, and you who listen, contributing your time and attention, translating the pops and burrs and squeaks of my voice into beauty upon the canvas of your cognition. You are responsible for this podcast. Without you, Daughter of Godcast is just binary patterns on whirling hard drives, hidden away in the secret server farms tended by men and women we'll never meet. Mystery upon mystery makes our connection possible. You, me, and mystery. Episode 018, Apocalypse Excelsior. This episode is already mostly introduction, so without further eloquence, let's wade into the middle of 2007.
The global catastrophe came and went when all the blessed were taken in the rapture event. I guess that proves that praying to Jesus was time well spent.
Endol dropped a working version of Foodip on January 4th, and then continued to tweak and enhance the mix in the months ahead. The opening theme set an episodic comedy tone, and put me in the mind that Dog could be a pilot for a series. Audio problems. I was having trouble with the dialogue audio. Fan noise and some great takes, and lowish volume. I tried various techniques for bringing up the speech while minimizing background noise, consulting with mixed professionals, equalization, noise-canceling software, but wasn't having much luck. By April, I was seriously considering ADR. ADR, or automatic dialogue replacement, involves getting the actors back and re-recording their dialogue in a sound studio. The actor watches and listens to a loop of their original performance, and then repeats that performance exactly so that the new audio recording matches the original. This usually proceeds line by line, a rather exacting process. Steve couldn't enter the USA for another 9 years. I would have to go to him. Currently, he was living in Vancouver, BC, on Canada's west coast, 3,000 miles away. His parents lived in Sudbury in northern Ontario, a day's drive from either Michigan or New York City. Finding an ADR-equipped studio in Sudbury seemed a stretch, and I would have to do Carmen eventually, too. That meant jury-rigging my own portable ADR setup. After some back and forth via email, Steve scheduled a Sudbury visit for August. I started talking to Carmen about perhaps flying to Switzerland to do ADR with her after that. Way live. Speaking of audio, our jam group had become even more of a thing. We had performed at the Dakar restaurant and taken on a name, Way, or What About You. We needed a name because we were participating in Make Music New York, a day of free live music all over the city on summer solstice. Plenty of emails were passed hither and yon, with lists of potential band names and requests to pick favorites. I like Heavy Cream Kittens. What about you? I think Blue Widgets would be fun. What about you? Eventually, What About You was the obvious winner. We deployed a website to share the music with each other and the world, which was mostly my thing. I was really into open sourcing and building the play it forward culture, which is kind of like pay it forward, except with art. On June 21st, WayLive rocked the Prospect Heights Community Farm, just adjacent to the United Gardens. The Wayists included Claire, Fabrice, Endon, Halige, Aji, Atsushi, Eleanor, Yvonne, Lori, Trevor, Cecile, Arabella, Tyrone, James, Todd, and occasionally Chuck, Nam, and Matt. Apocalypse Excelsior. Traveling to Kingston with Patrick in episode 016 had provided some post-apocalyptic establishing placeholders, but Endon wasn't impressed.
Endon just looks like some post-industrial age shit.
Just what I needed to hear. I gave myself permission to do what I guess I had wanted to do all along. In the original script, I had de-emphasized the post-apocalyptic context to keep things simple. Maho had found the big boat and brought back the context. And now Endon was saying,
"Don't be coy. Go ahead and embrace your inner apocalypse."
Daughter of God is supposed to be funny, but since it's about the apocalypse, then it must be dark humor, yeah? 'Cause how can a tragedy be funny? Years ago, my friend Cynthia lost her baby in her last trimester. She still had to go through labor, and another friend, Anita, and I accompanied her and her husband Bob to the hospital. The hospital had a birthing center, set up to give a homey feeling. Anita and I were alone in the family space adjacent to the birthing room. We could hear Sin crying and howling through the wall, not only from the pain of labor, but also from incredible loss. Anita and I sat there, stoically, uncomfortable, and feeling very sorry for our friend. Then we heard Cynthia scream out, "I'm giving birth to a dead baby!" Anita and I both turned to each other in total shock, and spontaneously, we started laughing. The only reaction possible. With so much pain and sorrow heavy in the room, Sin's shocking outcry teleported us beyond conditions and circumstance. This is likely my favorite memory with Anita, because we both transcended what we knew, beyond what was acceptable and appropriate, to what was true. Unabashed, unhinged humor. Could a post-apocalyptic world be beautiful? Could there be wonder and delight? Laughter? Even after a global catastrophe in which the better part of 7 billion humans were rubbed out, not to mention the collateral damage to countless other species and ecosystems. Back in 2007, I was very aware of the suicidal behavior of Americans. I knew lots of people who seemed to be perfectly at ease trashing the global life support system, not to mention their own health. I wanted to see past the inevitable outcome of silly choices to ultimate worthiness. For instance, imagine Earth rebounding. That could be lovely. Nature reclaiming the cities. A wild remediation of landfills and industrial sprawl. Tree roots tearing up acres of parking lots. Moss munching the asphalt. Other intriguing possibilities. Could keepers of the old paradigm be biding their time in armored bunkers? Did they have an inspired vision for renewal and reconstruction? And what if digital technology had achieved autonomy? Could there be a new category of life at large, wondering, asking the big questions? Okay, I'm going to go down. Going down.
Dive, dive.
Hey, hi. Oh. Oh, yes, we're podcasting. Oh, yes, I remember now. I think Americans have a fascination with apocalypse because we all realize on some level that we've been fucking up big time for decades, making dicey choices, and yet here we are, still. Eventually, there's going to be a reckoning, right? How many times can a teenager drive the family station wagon wasted? Or a minivan for you millennials. Guess there's no such thing as station wagons anymore. Smoking, steaming wrecks, tangled and flipped, oil and blood mixing on the highway. We've seen several variations of that on the silver screen. But there's always people left after the meteor, the tsunami, the plague. Otherwise, what's the story? Most post-apocalyptic scenarios seem to be redolent with retribution. Bad humans! Look what you've done! You deserve a spanking! Endon's critique helped me to realize Daughter of God's apocalyptic context required further cultivation. He reminded me of what I already knew, that I wanted to tinker with the trope of global catastrophe. An intriguing insight was waiting. Prepare to launch new expeditions. I scheduled another trip to Ann's in upstate New York. Murray Schrotenberg of Pike to Bike helped me to get access to an abandoned section of the Pennsylvania Turnpike near Breezewood, Pennsylvania, complete with tunnels. I scouted the turnpike on March 21st, and then my nephew Patrick and I braved misty, rainy weather from April 24th to the 27th. Later on, the turnpike was one of the locations for The Road in 2008, starring Viggo Mortensen. There's a scene where Viggo is wrestling with a marauder in a ditch. Patrick is pretty sure he took a pee there. In our first trip to Kingston, Patrick and I had gotten shots of railway cars belonging to a nonprofit, the Catskill Mountain Railway. Anne and her train partner, Gary, thought the board of directors would have no problem signing a location agreement. But unfortunately, they were a little spooked by the premise of our project. Anne lined up another railcar location in Pennsylvania. I was also intrigued by the bizarre Staten Island boat graveyard. Anne knew the owners and opined that access would be difficult to secure and expensive. I wrote to them, and sure enough, they never replied. For 5 days before my birthday on May 18th, I solo camped on North Manitou Island on Lake Michigan, a working birthday. North Manitou was a lumber farming community in the late 19th century, and then a game preserve before the National Park System gobbled it up in 1970. There are plenty of tumble-down cottages there, and wide expanses of wild Lake Michigan beach I could use as a visual effects backplate for a massive derelict cruise ship. A beached cruise ship could represent the metaphor of consumer culture, run aground and quietly rusting away, forgotten. My nephew Jonathan had been working with the open source 3D modeling application Blender, and he was willing to help. I'm back. We looked at some free and commercially available 3D models, but nothing really fit our criteria. By May 6th, he'd completed the first version of the cruise ship. Here's a test render of the model getting attacked by aliens. Bonus. I spent 5 days on North Manitou, experimenting with other post-apocalyptic ideas and backplates. I had brought a stack of $20 bills with me as props, and I tried weaving them into the grass and leaves of a sun-dappled meadow, a sort of surreal suggestion of a ruptured ATM or a crashed armored car. I left the bills overnight, and when I returned for the morning light, they were covered with slugs. What could this be a metaphor for? I don't know, but sublime. Some almonds are harder to skin than others. I acquired enough intriguing shots on the island to make a mini documentary, Some Almonds Are Harder to Skin Than Others, about my fresh and raw response to a culture not only of consumption, but of endless war, avenging 9/11 or whatever. No one was quite sure anymore why we went to Iraq or why we were still there. 4 years since I laid down under Army Reserve tanker trucks. The previous March, I had joined a rowdy evening war protest that snaked through Midtown. At Union Square, this crazy street band came out of nowhere and led us west and north. We were eventually blocked by police barricades from proceeding further uptown. As I marched, I blew my conch, an homage to my friend and the venerable Yogi Raj, Swami Bua. The Tao of Yoga. In 2006, Swamiji's apartment had been taken over by one of his daughters and her husband. In January, I invited Swami to move in with me at Prospect Heights so he could reestablish consistent teaching and the fresh and raw diet, which was one of the pillars of his longevity. We toured my apartment, but he declined, citing the 2 flights of stairs. I fell out of favor with his relatives after this. In May of 2007, I had news that Swami had moved to Queens with his other daughter, Premlata, and her husband, Rajaram, a welcome change. They were all planning a trip to India in August. To join Swamiji in India would have been amazing, but there was a movie to finish. If only I had known the movie would take another 9 years. No regrets. I persisted with Swamiji's yoga and practiced Tai Chi with Master Ru and the South Street Seaport family on the weekends. I also ran in Prospect Park, and starting in May, extreme urban biking. I had finally rolled Steve Ziliak's bike out of the hallway, had it tuned at the bike shop, and bought a Black Diamond climbing helmet. After a couple of months of flats, I upgraded to Kevlar street tires. This was before the city became pedal-friendly, just as bike lanes were grudgingly beginning to appear. White ghost bikes still haunted local street corners, where bikers had been killed by cars. I adopted a self-reliant style of riding. No one could see me, and if they did, they didn't care. I was fleet and flip. The only quarter I gave was to pedestrians. I loved solving the dynamic geometry of pothole and intersection, swinging through rushing rivers of crushing steel, fully free. My chronic lumbar pelvic pain still flared up occasionally, but I just sort of blustered through. There just wasn't time to be disabled. Selling and buying. On October 10, 2006, I had met the inventor of the Steadicam, Garrett Brown, at the New York Cine and Digital Equipment Show, and was inspired by his presentation. I had used my GlideCam on the big boat, but realized it wasn't plug and play. When a two-day Steadicam training was offered at Adorama on March 18th through the 19th of 2007, I signed up. Afterwards, I came home and retuned my GlideCam so that it flew true. I was now acutely aware of its limitations and dreamed of getting a real Steadicam, a flyer, for about $7,000. I could then graduate to a new level of expertise and earning and select commercial productions and or moving more intimately in stage performance. To this end, I started to liquidate equipment. On March 22nd, I posted my XL2, GlideCam, Explorer tripod, Fender PA, and a Mac laptop on Craigslist. This would generate almost $5,000, approaching the cost of a flyer. By May, I had sold the GlideCam, the Mac, and the XL2. Earning money. A steady stream of new performance documentation clients were showing up, including Clarinda Maclow and Unjung Gonzalez. I was discussing movie-only collaborations with several of my established clients. Let's see what we got here. Facebook. And go. Bam. Come on, Alexandra. Oh, come on, Alexandra. Come on, come on. Donna, that's what I thought. Thank you. On January 14th, I had reached out to Donna Hash at the dance department of Long Island University's Brooklyn campus with the idea of establishing a citywide dance archive. From Danny Kelly, anything at. Subject, thoughts. Date, January 14th, 2007. To Donna Hash. You know I've got this giant archive of dance from the past 3 years. I've always thought it would be cool for dancers to be able to see more of the work that's going on around the city, or even more of what's gone down over the past decade. Imagine a huge database of performance on the web that dancers could freely contribute new work to. Of course, there are lots of company and personal websites, but what if there was an attempt to create an open archive? Would that be useful? Lots of artists would suddenly have a venue to find a wider audience, and a huge number of people would have access to dance. Think of the hookups with the city and tourism, with recruitment of new students to study in New York City, of collaborations among all the different academic institutions offering dance programs, of the theaters large and small, on and on. Cha-ching! Technically, it would require some web infrastructure, storage capacity, and intern-based facilitation, but I suspect most of the operations could be automated. Think of how cool it would be if LIU facilitated this project, and the result was this huge boom in the appreciation and attendance of dance around the city, around the country for that matter. I must say, this idea was brilliant, but didn't have legs with LIU or Donna. After switching my web provider to Bluehost later that year, I had the horsepower to establish my own proof-of-concept dance archive, in higher resolution than was offered by either YouTube or Vimeo at the time. I've had fantasies about reestablishing that archive, perhaps on YouTube or Vimeo. I'd guess I have about 100 hours. Laura Peterson amped up our collaboration with her project, I Love Dan Flavin. On January 24th, I shot a rehearsal and performance, and then guided Laura to log and make selects, deciding which shots she liked most. We were attempting to get her to take over the offline edit so she could improve her documentation without breaking her budget. We were having so much fun together, building a workflow to support even more ambitious future projects. Based on my work with Laura, Gerald Castle, and others, I cut a demo reel in late May. The idea was to promote myself as the documenter of choice among the independent dance community. Eventually, initiate bigger projects with more robustly resourced clients, if they existed. Ready to contribute to other indie movie projects with decent budgets, if they existed. Dog is not done. Looking back at the first half of 2007, I was booming. A very productive 6 months. The finish date for Daughter of God stretched farther into the future, but not for lack of inspired action, but because of inspired action. Carmen was anxious for an excerpt, so she could land some new roles in Switzerland, but I was reluctant to release anything until the contracts were settled. And by March, these were sent out. And I have my towel right here. Around this time, I tested Daughter of God with a small gathering of mostly native French speakers and my friend Yvonne. The French people mostly didn't get it, but YV spontaneously guffawed at all the right parts. Bless her, I knew the project was on track. I had actually scheduled a screening on February 17th for the Dog is Done Chinese Lunar New Year party at the United Gardens. But my flight back from my dad's birthday in episode 017 got screwed up, and I had to cancel. That was for the best. Dog wasn't really done, anyway. I was starting to realize that I wanted this movie to be more. Just like the treatment of the apocalypse, there was more story to be discovered. I began to be less concerned with finishing fast, and more concerned with getting it right. Probably a big red flag. You've been taking in the Daughter of God cast, stories from the making of the quirky sci-fi featurette Daughter of God with a quirky writer and director, Dan Kelly, a.k.a. Shri Fuji Split, spelled Shri Fuji Spilt, but pronounced in the original ASEAN, Shri Fuji, like the Japanese mountain, and Split as in banana. The apocalypse is often viewed from a dark place. People barely surviving, not enough video games and bacon cheeseburgers to go around. So many dead people, loved ones lost, parents, children, sisters, and brothers. What if we're totally wrong about death? What if the only reason death feels like loss is because we're out of tune with the universe? If we could feel what we actually are, everything we imagine to be problematic would be a blessing.